It took us a long time to perfect space travel to the point we are today. Projects to colonize and terraform Mars came and went with limited success, but each effort spurred on.
Unmanned ships sent back images of planets that might suit the purpose better and be easier starting points, but they were so far away.
We couldn't travel there in one human lifetime, and we stumbled over the weight calculation paradox. Any ship sent that deep into space would arrive with technology so obsolete by the time that they arrived that it was possible that missions sent later would pass it in the process. It became a technological race between two competing theories. Either we colonize Mars and make it habitable and spread through the universe in small steps, or we perfect technology capable of carrying us deeper into space faster. The middle ground was the daunting prospect of human volunteers launching into space on ships designed to be self-sustaining, living their lives in space and continuing the species on board until they arrived at their destination, unsure if the world they left behind had already rendered their sacrifice meaningless through advancement. In the end, gradual colonization won out. The first success missions to house people on Mars and make farming there sustainable created a launching platform for deeper space exploration. The resources required to make Mars livable called for large space stations to orbit and aid colonizers for the first few generations. But after their mission was declared a success and the colonies became self-sufficient, the stations were repurposed. Zero-G vacuum construction was introduced. Spaceships designed to travel only in space and not required to be aerodynamic or escape an atmosphere. They could be built solely with space travel in mind and without the limitations of a terrain liftoff. This gave way to different engine designs that couldn't have hoped to have work in an atmosphere or while trying to escape one, and hand in hand, the two theories became one. Using planets as stepping stones had given birth to space vehicles which could cover greater distances in space in shorter times. Space exploration was born in earnest. Humans could travel to nearby planets and back in time frames that made it possible to mine worlds that couldn't be inhabited as one-week-on, one-week-off day jobs. Exploring newly discovered planets or previously unexplored ones was no longer the job of a crew of dedicated professionals as one-in-a-lifetime voyage, but became the task of squads of trained men and women as regular jobs. As more planets became home to human life, the pool of human resources expanded and non-government-funded missions became a reality as privately owned spacecraft probed the void for discoveries that would return on their investment. Lawyers bickered and argued over what rights any one person or persons had over whole worlds. Scientists raced to classify newfound elements and be the first to discover uses for them.
And quietly, in the background, theorists and thinkers warned us that the chances of us not having found any life in our expansion so far were so utterly infinitesimal that there had to be another explanation.
Or that our discovery of extraterrestrial life was a ticking bomb, waiting to go off, and that the exploration should be tightly controlled, lest some greedy cowboy desperate for a quick dollar be the one to make first contact and we all suffer for their lack of preparation.
In retrospect, there's a part of me that wishes I'd paid more attention to them.
It wasn't unusual for our ship to find work ferrying cargo back and forth between stations as contractors for exploration crews. In an effort to outdo each other, they took small, fast ships and raced each other to unexplored locations, roll the proverbial dice to see who would stumble over something worth keeping, then claim it, and set beacons for larger freight haulers like us to come, pick it up, and return it to the nearest research station. They get paid a fortune for their discovery. We get paid a small percentage for the round trip. It made my head spin seeing some of the amounts they got on their paychecks, but I consoled myself that they were taking all the big risks by visiting these unknown corners of the universe. My pay as security officer might not have been anything like theirs, but my job mostly involved sitting quietly in the security office, pretending to watch the cameras as I read or watched reruns of shows I stored on a portable hard drive, and from time to time, breaking up drunken squabbles between hired miners. Fairly safe work. It had reached the point that where, because we often spent weeks in space at a time, I had set the monitors and alarms up in my office so that I can control the volume and display finally. When most of the crew were asleep, I could hook up a computer to the hard drive, change the sound over to the shows I wanted to watch, and just relax. If anything went wrong, the visual alarms would alert me, and the computer would produce instant reports that always took precedent over anything else that was displayed on the screen. There was no harm in making weeks of travel less boring. Besides, it wasn't like downtime ever lasted long. The captain, Rebecca Green, was forever calling meetings and asking for updates. I swear she only did it because she didn't want us treating the ship as our own personal cruise ship. Captain Green had called me and the other ranking officers to her office when we had picked up the call of the beacon. She explained that we were close by and the price on offer was huge, but she'd been suspicious. Details on the package were scarce and the money came with a fairly explicit no-questions-asked policy. It wasn't like we hadn't picked up cargo like this before. Plenty of crazy frontier types didn't like to send out beacons explaining what they had found in fear of someone snatching it up. But with the kind of figures we were seeing on this pay offer, and the fact that the cargo came pre-packed and ready for transport, meaning we wouldn't have to share the pay with hired miners or extra crew, we all instantly smelled the bullshit. That sure as hell wasn't stopping us from signing on to grab it. We could all speculate over the bullshit later as we were building new wings into our houses and trying to decide where to put our new pools. We marked the beacon as taken and changed our heading to go collect it. We detached the recovery vessel and gone to the planet's surface to collect the package. Captain Green spent her time talking to Dr. Freestone about the planet. Whoever discovered it was blessed, Freestone had said, running some numbers in his head as he looked at the planet. The jungles and mountains in the habitable zone of a nearby sun. Assuming it had some breathable air, someone was going to be rich. We all marveled at the beautiful green jewel on the other side of the viewing window as the cargo collection vessel returned and docked. My chance to marvel was at an end the moment the ship finished connecting back up with us, as my first, and hopefully only, duties were to check the cargo and help old Doc Freestone check the crew. As soon as we saw the cargo container, I was on the comms to Green. There were air holes. There was movement. The crew looked spooked. It was live cargo.
"We should just fucking shoot it back into space,"
I argued with her as she held up her hands for calm, her office door tightly closed. The crew outside pretending not to know that Green Freestone, First Officer Lucy Jennings, and I were bickering fiercely inside. Freestone and I both argued that we weren't set up to take anything alive, had no idea what the creature might be capable of, or if its prison would hold, and couldn't speak to whatever kind of disease it might be spitting out with every breath, assuming it did breathe. The captain and Jennings tried to talk us down. They hadn't seen the size of the crate in question. They hadn't heard the bulk of the creature inside moving.
"I don't care about the pay. Take my cut. Just for the love of God, don't ask us to make the trip back with that thing on board. We have no idea what we've got there, and it's not worth the risk."
It didn't matter what I said. The idea of losing that paycheck, of having to pay the value of the cargo for losing it. The captain agreed to seal up the cargo hold with the deployment hatch on standby. If anything happened, we could remotely open the hatch, and the whole hold would open up into the vacuum. The doc and I didn't feel much better, but Jennings herded us out of the office and started to give orders to get moving. The conversation was at an end. Freestone and I exchanged looks, his brow furrowed. I must have looked like I was going to grind my teeth down to nubs. I felt my fists clench so hard that my fingernails dug into my palm a little, the sting helping to dull the mixture of anger and fear I felt. Bless the cheeky bastard. He looked me in the eye and smiled. Told me to take half a Valium and get rest before I burst a blood vessel. There was something about Ben Freestone that relaxed me a little naturally. He was handsome enough, nearing his late 30s with full black hair and just a streak of gray, clean-shaven and healthy. He had a pair of hazel eyes that easily pulled off stern, serious talk doctor and caring family doctor at a whim. He seemed to genuinely care about the crew. I took his advice. I figured there was no way I was going to be sleeping with that kind of tension I was feeling while that thing was on board. I downed half the pill, sat down to watch the monitor staring at the camera cargo hold one. The crate sat there, unmoving. There was sound on the cameras, but because of the deployment hatch had been set to standby, The only sound that came through was the constant droning of the emergency alarm warning anyone in the hold to evacuate before the doors were opened. Before long, I had to switch it into silent. I wasn't going to hear anything over that noise anyway. I stared at the crate. None of us had dared to look inside. It was solid metal with three holes on each face to act as air holes. We could have gotten a torch and peered in through one, but nobody was fool enough to push their face up against the crate with a live, unknown animal inside. An hour passed, and it felt like I had barely blinked. I felt the tension of the argument starting to drain away. 3 days in transit. All I had to do was hold out for 3 days. I could do that. I let myself relax a little, and before I knew it, my chin was touching my chest. I jerked upright in the seat, my eyes dart accusingly back at the monitor for cargo hold one. But the crate was still there, unopened. I felt the volume working, and a sense of lethargy made my limbs feel heavy. But with a burst of energy born of the panicking feeling of having almost fallen asleep, I flipped the sound back on, only to hear nothing but the constant drone of the warning system still advising all personnel to evacuate the cargo bay. The rush of adrenaline wore off quickly, and as it did, the drowsiness returned. Clumsily, I slapped my palm against the sound settings for the monitors as my eyes grew heavy, flicking at the switch until the siren was silenced again. In moments, I was asleep in the chair. I was awoken by the sound of the doors locking with a sharp click. My eyes snapped open, and I struggled to catch my balance in the chair as the sudden awakening nearly sent me tumbling to the floor. It took a moment for the effects of the volume and the general exhaustion to shake off, but when it did, I realized that the room was flashing red. Emergency lighting was on, the overhead alarm was flashing on and off, the computer was producing readouts. The alarms were going off. But they weren't making any noise. It was with a sudden sinking feeling in my stomach that I remembered turning off the sound to the monitors and looked up. Sure enough, I had accidentally turned the sound off for all alarms, switching it over to the silent mode I had rigged up to watch movies. Panic pumped through me, and my stomach threatened to drag itself into my throat as my eyes scanned the monitors. Cargo hold one was there. And with horror, I saw the crate, its sides fallen open, its content missing. The computers told the story. Unidentified life forms had entered into the air ducts in cargo hold one. Life forms? Plural? That had been 3 minutes ago. After the life forms had been identified moving through the ship in various locations, and there hadn't been any recognition from me at the security desk, the ship had gone into automatic lockdown. There was the sound that had woken me up, the sound of the door sealing. I grabbed the comms and hit the button to bring the captain online, my heart threatening to explode out of my chest as it pounded.
Captain, this is Amanda in security. Do you copy?
I released the button and paused, waiting for her reply. My hands were shaking. I couldn't count how many heartbeats I waited.
Captain Green, come in. This is security. We have an emergency.
Still dead air. I swallowed, trying to force myself to calm down. For all I knew, she had been asleep and was dragging herself out of bed to answer the comms. I waited, but it didn't take long for the silence to become frightening.
Rebecca, come in. We have to blow the hatch to cargo hold one and take account of the crew right now. The cargo crate is open and the computer is picking up life signs. Rebecca!
Nothing. I prayed that she was already aware, busy trying to contain the situation. I knew I was in for a world of hurt when she found out I'd slept through 3 minutes of alarms. For a second, I imagined trying to excuse it, explaining to her that I had gotten the alarms but had been trying to locate and lock down all access to the cargo hold. It was momentarily comforting to imagine that we would all be out of this mess soon and I could be explaining myself. I had to find her. I looked back up to the monitors and started to change the cameras to areas I thought she might be. I started with the command deck. Some crew were there, as always, but I scanned through the faces and didn't see her. They didn't look worried. The alarms were showing on their end, but they knew they didn't have to panic until I activated the evacuation alarms, so they stayed at their stations to ensure the ship continued on its current headings. I checked the mess hall. Nobody. I checked her quarters. The cameras were set to private. She often did that when she went to sleep. A lot of the crew did. I had emergency codes to override that setting, and this felt like an emergency to me. I grabbed the comm one more time.
Rebecca, if you're in your quarters, I'm turning on the camera. This is too serious.
I hit the override and stare. Slack-jawed at the sight. Rebecca's naked flesh was glowing in the red light of the emergency alarm. She was suspended about 3 feet off the ground, her toes pointed, her back arched, her bare breasts thrust up towards the roof of her private room, her head thrown back and her long blonde hair, normally done up in a tight professional-looking bun, hung loose and fell about her like a river of gold, splashed with the crimson of the warning lights. Something had her and was holding her there. It seemed purple in color, with the strange light shining off its glistening skin. It almost looked like it was made of rubber, glossy and stretchy like children's Play-Doh. There was a central bulb, blob-like and thick with muscle, about a man's fully grown torso and total mass, and a half-dozen long tentacles, each about as thick as a garden hose, lashing the air, grasping Rebecca firmly by her ankles, wrists, and throat. They ended in what looked like three petaled flowers which could open up, the thick and rubbery petals starting to reveal a moist, pink central mass which was what grasped Rebecca so tightly now and held her aloft, each slightly larger with a grip slightly wider than a man's hand. Each limb seemed prehensile and capable of independent movement, and as they moved, it was obvious they were deceptively strong and very flexible. They held Rebecca taut, like her weight was nothing, the muscles in the limbs easily compensating for any movement she made. I felt my throat constrict and my heart skipped a beat. The creature didn't seem to have eyes or a mouth that could see, but it was clearly trying to attack Rebecca and had her entangled and trapped. The movement of the tentacles almost seemed lazy and calm, languid and easy. And it dawned on me that Rebecca wasn't thrashing or kicking wildly. Her eyes were closed, her body rocking gently. And then I saw it. One of the tentacles snaked between her pale thighs, moving in a rhythmic, pulsing manner, matching the motions of Rebecca's body that, it suddenly dawned on me, were laced with lust and a relaxed kind of pleasure. As her legs moved in the creature's appendage, the petals spread open, one resting on her apex, covering her clit and pubic mound. The other two slipped under her thighs and cupping her backside. It possessively covered her sex, the muscles pulsing and twitching, fist-sized bumps moving through the limb as if it was pumping something into her. I looked at Rebecca's face. Her lips parted and moist, her cheeks aglow, her eyes closed in a peaceful kind of bliss. Each time one of the large bumps reached the tip of the tentacle, I saw her eyes shoot open and go wide, her mouth open wider, her body tighten. Then the shape would vanish through the stem of the monster and disappear into Rebecca. Her eyes would roll back, her body shudder all over, twitching, her toes pointing sharply and her legs shaking. And then she'd relax back into her blissful pose. It was a terrifying mixture of a beautiful woman in a state of sexual ecstasy and the most alien and horrific violation of someone I personally called a friend I had ever seen. A horrid, contradictory wave of arousal and revulsion swept over me. She looked like an angel, stretched out, her body taut, her face a mask of pure pleasure, like a painting created by a master to be the epitome of woman's beauty and sexuality. And she was being defiled by a monster, disgusting and frightening, designed by that same painter to show raw perversion made manifest. I felt sickened by myself as I found myself unable to look away from the sight. I wanted to press the button and hear the sound. I knew it was wrong. But as another bump reached her hidden sex, and I saw her face come alive in shocked passion before her features became an animal look of pure orgasm, I wanted to hear it. I wanted to hear the sound my friend made as she was taken by this monster. I rationalized. I would turn the sound on, but not because I wanted to hear. I'd turn it on so I could hit the comm again and see if I could hear it in the room with her. Then, at least I would know if she could hear me. My sense of morality buckled under my excuse and my curiosity. I didn't let myself think of the sense of desire I felt rising. I reached up slowly, as if moving too quickly might startle Rebecca or the monster, even though I knew they couldn't hear me, my finger lingering over the sound button. Was I really this sick that I wanted to press it and hear all this? I should be grabbing my sidearm and overriding the lockdown right now. My finger hit the button and the sound came on. My face flushed and my breath caught, held tight in my chest, not wanting the sound of it to interrupt what I heard. Rebecca's sound was bestial and instinctive, raw and mindless. She groaned like an animal in heat, all traces of dignity and self-consciousness utterly lost in wave after wave of endless ecstasy. It was so unlike her. She was so prim and proper, uptight and dignified. It felt like she could never, even when making love, make sounds like this. But here she was, her hips pumping back and forth against the invading tentacle. Her nipples hardened to tiny pink flowers, her lips parted in panting breaths, making noises like a primal creature. Every time she breathed in, I could hear her sucking in desperate breaths. Each time she breathed out, she groaned, a sound somewhere between a pleasure so intense it overwhelmed her, and a pain so dull and all-encompassing that it numbed her whole body. I felt my body respond in kind. Suddenly, I became acutely aware of the fabric of my bra as it pressed against my nipples, each breath causing them to rub together with a delicious kind of friction that taunted me and tugged at my attention, building in me a lingering desire to feel the aching tips pinched and squeezed, like an itch that wouldn't pass. I heard Rebecca's cries start to rise in volume and intensity. With each breath, she started to sound less like a wounded, panting animal and more like a woman in pleasure. I saw her eyes open and her head lift from its careless, draped position as she looked down at the monster that fucked her endlessly. I saw why as I followed her eyes. Another fist-shaped lump being pumped slowly and purposefully through the tube-like limb had made its way to her entrance. It must be stretching her wide, filling her, pushing and demanding entrance to her. I felt my body grow warm and an ache start to form between my legs as I squeezed my thighs closed tightly, gently rubbing them together, instinctively trying to temper the urge I felt building there. It was a base and foolish thought. I knew from experience that the stimulation would only make my need grow, but I couldn't help myself. As I listened, Rebecca's whimpers and pants grew to a high, fevered pitch, and then the shape vanished from the tube and up into her pussy. She cried out, her breath catching, choking on her own bliss as her body spasmed in another orgasm. I felt my mouth hang open as I watched and listened. She came like her life was ending as the monster delivered whatever it was depositing into her. I could almost imagine how something that thick must have felt going into her. God. Rebecca's eyes were rolled back in her head, her tongue lolling like a dog as she came down. My hands had undone my belt. I don't know when it happened. I didn't care. I watched in silence, my breath short, my fingers disappearing under the elastic of my panties. Heat greeted me. Why was I like this? Why was I so turned on by this? My fingers brushed against the hood of my clit, the soft, sensitive fold covering the little hard button that twitched once with anticipation, and I heard my concerns escape my mouth in a side rush of air. The sensation ran straight through me, battering at my rational fears and concerns as my eyes fixed on the rolling of Rebecca's hips, and my finger dipped lower, feeling the warm wetness of my arousal as I ran a circle around my tight little passage and back up to my clit, spreading the slick juices of my desire across myself. I matched the movements of her on the screen on myself, and tried to imagine what she must be feeling. Her eyes focused again and leaned up. She and the monster seemed synchronized. It moved one of its tentacles up towards her head. She parted her lips wide, making a sound like a hungry child urgently wanting something in her mouth. I watched with fascination, two fingers slipping down my sex and pressing at my hungry entrance, as the monster's tentacle opened up. With my free hand, I reached out and hit the zoom, getting a close-up shot of the appendage and its strange tip. From this angle, I could see more. The inner part of each petal was pink and glistened with a slime that seemed to coat the inside. It was lined with small bumps that almost seemed to wriggle on their own, writhing, squirming. It was disgusting. Yet, at the same time, I remembered the petal pressed tightly over Rebecca's sex, clamped on, holding her. I pulled my fingers back and softly tapped my clit quickly as I tried to guess what these rolling bumps must feel like pulsing and massaging her. In the center of the creature's makeshift maw was an extendable and retractable part of the tube that made up the inside of the tentacle, through which the bumps must have been passing. It was as pink and raw looking as the rest of the inside of the tip, phallic in shape. About as thick as two fingers, but clearly designed to flex and stretch around the bulges. I watched Rebecca lift her head up towards the lowering tentacle, and the sound of her moans became muffled as the central semi-cock-shaped part pushed into her mouth, and the petals closed over her, one on either cheek, another over the top of her head, cradling it as I watched her throat swallow over and over, drinking deeply of something. I couldn't take it anymore. I've moved my fingers back down to my waiting pussy, the tease over, the need too much for me. They slid in easily, my honey soaking my underwear and coating my digits as they stretched me and I groaned out in wanton need. I rested the heel of my palm against my clit, hooked up my fingers up inside me as if I were trying to touch my palm, and began to move my hand. I wanted to match the rhythm of the sight on the screen, but it only took moments for me to lose my pace and feel my fingers start to speed up on their own. I fought to keep my eyes from closing in pleasure, locking them on the scene of Rebecca drinking in the monster's cum hungrily, her hips still rolling to meet every thrust as though she couldn't get enough, as though there would never be an orgasm big enough to satisfy her. I knew how she felt. The tentacle pulled away from her face, and I saw her desperately sucking the central stem, trying to hold on to it, whimpering like she was being denied. As it slipped from her mouth, her tongue darted out, caressing it as it left, like it was a lover. Her eyes glazed. Her lips went with something milky that ran like water down one cheek and her chin as she tried to catch it up, her lips vanishing between her teeth as she sucked on them. Her tongue flicking out as far as it could to catch as many drops from her chin and cheek as possible. Then her fitful lapping stopped, and her eyes focused again and grew wide. I knew that look. My fingers started to move deeper and faster, my palm pounding against my pussy as I fucked myself. I looked down at the same time as Rebecca did, spotting the lump moving up the tentacle towards her. I could hear her whispering, "Yes, yes, yes, more." Or was it me who had said that? My body started to tense. I could feel it tightening like a spring. My hand lost all sense of rhythm and patience, pounding and grinding into myself. Anything to build that sense of pleasure and tightness inside me more. As I watched Rebecca's mouth start to open wide and her cries start to rise, mine copied, the sound of my own need mimicking hers. I felt my pussy tighten and twitch around my fingers, all the muscles fluttering as the orgasm threatened to explode a moment too early. With all my might, I held it back. My voice caught in my throat, my eyes locked on that lump trying to squeeze into Rebecca's passage. Then she screamed. The lump pushed inside her as she came. I screamed with her and felt a rare gush of fluids wash over my hands, soaking me. I couldn't look at the screen. My eyes rolled back and my head fell back, hanging half off the chair as my sex clenched and milked my fingers. I could smell my musk filling the room, sweet and intoxicating as my tremors came in shorter and shorter waves. The scream became a sob, the sob a moan, the moan a whisper as I slowly came down. My fingers stationary inside me, the flesh too sensitive to move right now. I caught my breath, sitting still, my eyes closed. As the pleasure eased away, something else took its place. A sense of guilt. Had I really just done this? Wasted precious moments here like a wild animal touching myself, watching my friend ravished by some alien? I wanted to cry. I wanted to leap into action, but my body was too shaky for just a moment. My legs too weak. And I heard a metallic thud behind me. The sound of the grate covering one of the air ducts being knocked out. In the reflection of one of the monitors, I saw it. Something heavy, large, purple and rubbery landed in the office, many long limbs lowering itself to the floor.